It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, a look at the American tradition of resistance. My guest, award-winning Iowa historian and journalist Jeff Biggers. He has a new book out, Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. Its jumping-off point is the present, but he looks back at resistance movements in U.S. history, from the American Revolution to the defeat of fascism in World War II, to the civil rights movement, environmental movements, also to the present day. Jeff Biggers in the studio with me in Iowa City. Welcome back to our program, Jeff.
Thanks very much for having me, Ben.
To ask, first of all, to read a passage, but before you do that, why write this book and why write it now?
You know, these are trying times, Ben, as Thomas Paine would tell us. And about a year ago, actually more than a year ago, my 12-year-old son came to me when President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. And he had a simple question as a child. He said, "Is there hope?" You know, and you can't be glib with your child when they ask such profound questions, such serious questions, especially, you know, as we're looking with the West aflame right now and record heat waves across the world. And I really felt like I couldn't just simply give him a lecture on climate change. I needed to go back into history as a historian and look at deeper movements in other darker, trying times to let him know that ultimately hope resists. And that we have this long continuum of resistance that has pulled us through as a nation, and that once again we need to look to our history to be able to respond to times today.
Mm-hmm. What if you could read a little something from your introduction of the book?
Certainly. Resistance, as an American credo, blossomed from the seed time of our American Revolution as a universal right, not simply some random act to disrupt civil order or stability, or fleeting moments of dissent or vague calls for freedom, as often defined. You see, resistance over centuries has endowed a public commons for we the people to have a voice in framing the defining issues in our most trying times.
Jeff Biggers, historian, journalist, playwright with me in the studio today. Resistance, the name of his latest book, Reclaiming an American Tradition. If you'd like to join our conversation, what's your take on resistance and its place in American history? Do you see it differently than Jeff does? In a little while, we'll have Tim Walsh, presidential historian, join us as well with his version of resistance, what he would like to point out in our American history. But please join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you've been part of a resistance movement that you'd like to share with us. Jeff Biggers has. I've read in your book, Jeff, 1985. In fact, your cellmate was your mentor, Reverend William Sloan Coffin. You served as his personal aide at a church in New York City.
Right. William Sloan Coffin, of course, is known as Reverend Sloan in the Doonesbury cartoon. He was a very acclaimed and well-known anti-war activist. He had been the Yale chaplain and went on to Riverside Church in New York City. But I think what a lot of people didn't know that he was the first preacher to be part of the Alabama Freedom Rides in 1961. And in fact, was beaten and put in jail. And he often talked about that experience as being a defining experience to really see the power of nonviolent resistance. And he told me that story when, in fact, we were sitting in jail in 1985. We had been part of the Free South Africa movement. I don't know if you recall that, you know, in the mid-1980s, our president at the time, President Reagan, refused to put sanctions on South Africa during the apartheid system. And he was quite critical of Nelson Mandela. And so we felt the only way to affect change was to use the time-honored tradition of civil disobedience. We blocked the doors at the South African embassy for over 400 days as part of a national movement and ultimately moved the nation forward to recognize, of course, the abomination of apartheid, which eventually fell, of course.
Mm-hmm. In this book, you call Reverend William Sloan Coffin your mentor. In what way has he shaped your views specifically about resistance?
You know, once again, Bill was sitting in a jail cell in Alabama, and I recalled my own experience of feeling like, you know, it's kind of hopeless what we're doing. It's kind of useless, these kind of efforts of protest. We go into the streets, we go to the voting booths, but often we feel as if our voice is not heard and there's no real change happening. And I think Coffin tried to remind me from his own experience that, you know, if we're in it for the long haul, that change may not happen tomorrow. But there is that fundamental seed that we're seeding that will hopefully bring some sense of justice in the future. In fact, it's Bill who told me, hopelessness adapts, but it's hope that resists. and that we really have to be in it is for the long haul.
When you look at history, you look to Revolutionary War times, in fact, before the Revolutionary War in one instance. But take us back to who is a figure who is definitely center stage in this book, Thomas Paine. Remind us of the role he played in our Revolutionary War times and why his acts of resistance, his writings, Common Sense, and the Crisis pamphlets figure so heavily into what you're trying to get across here.
You know, Ben, I think Thomas Paine is really one of our most forgotten founding forerunners. Here's the person who actually first inscribed the words United States of America, the first person who really galvanized our resolve to move forth in our independence movement in the American Revolution. You know, I think it was John Adams who, after the Revolution, you know, bitterly said, oh, the history is going to ascribe the American Revolution to Tom Paine, that in fact it was the pen of Paine and not the sword of Washington. And what happened actually was in 1775, in this really trying time after the British troops had gunned down our patriots in Lexington and Concord, that's a chapter of history we all learn about by kids as kids, we don't really realize that still there wasn't the resolve to move toward independence by a majority of Americans, or especially the colonial elite. And here comes this immigrant, this undocumented immigrant, this man who we consider the dreg, someone who is twice a debtor, who had broken marriages, who comes over on a boat and he's full of diseases. And this man came because he was inspired by our resistance movements, and he found it amongst young people who are trying to move forward the colonial elite in Philadelphia. And to make a long story short, Paine began to publish these amazing stories in a magazine. For example, one of the first poems he ever published was by an enslaved African-American poet, Phyllis Wheatley, who wrote, "To every action let the goddess guide." And she wrote this wonderful poem to George Washington about tyranny. And I think what's important is that Tom Paine realized we needed to include we the people and all the voices to truly move and galvanize the American resistance forward. In the January 10th of 1776, he published a pamphlet that went on to be quite possibly the most well-read book in American history outside of the Bible, and that was called Common Sense. It was his call for independence to refer to the brutish leader of Great Britain, to push people who were sitting on the fence to say, if you're not going to lead, you need to get out of the way, that we have to move forward not only in seeking our freedom, but to reinvent our world as Americans. And this kind of powerful call really changed the narrative and the scope of the American Revolution and seeded who we are today with this fundamental credo that is our most patriotic act to resist duplicitous authority whenever our sense of democracy is attacked.
Mm-hmm. I wonder who qualifies in your mind, looking back through American history as a resistor, anyone who resists, or are there more qualifications necessary when you selected history to frame our current time?
Right. I think that's a great question. You know, once again, Thomas Paine said, hey, here's a fundamental definition of what resistance is, that as Americans, once again, it's a fundamental duty to resist when we have an authoritarian overreach of our democracy. And so it's very clear, Ben, it's not that we're attacking the White House. It's not that we're attacking President Trump, for example, today, but we're defending the very democracy which we ceded over 270 years ago. And so who are resistors? It's not simply people who want to protest or people who are against something, but it's people who realize the fundamental need to work together to bring in and support the very pillars of our democracy today. And that would be people, of course, who've worked for our civil rights, for our immigrant rights, and for many other stages up till today where people are really working on issues of environmental justice and environmental rights.
Jeff Biggers is with us. His latest book, yeah, Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. In the book, he ties American history into the present times with that theme, resistance. I'd like to have you tie Iowa into this book as well. I think you have a passage there. I wonder if you could read another passage as well that talks about Iowa, an Iowa resistor, tying into the present time. And we'd like to have you join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We jump to the present from the times of Thomas Paine to what? Set this up.
Well, this was happening about 2 years ago when, of course, I think our nation was transfixed by the showdown by Native Americans at Standing Rock, which, of course, is just above us in South Dakota, really realizing that there was going to be a pipeline stretching from the Canadian border all the way through the Dakotas, through Iowa, through farmland, through private property, all the way down to the Mississippi River. And I think what inspired me was to realize that there was a group in Iowa City called the 100 Grannies. And once again, I think often when we live in a college town, we're obsessed with youth culture, that somehow social change is always in the hands of the young. And in fact, I end my book saying, you know, now the resistance is in the hands of a new generation. But I think it's often very important to point out that it has been people, older people, who have had the resolve to move forward, likewise, and be very courageous in these social justice movements for resistance. And that, for me, is the 100 Grannies group here in Iowa City. The Grannies went down to the Mississippi River, and they began to set up their own blockade, and they actually went on to a site that was setting up a pipeline. And this, to me, was a very, very important moment for Iowa, but also looking back to an event even like the Boston Tea Party, where once again we had a protest over trade, over our natural resources, where Americans boarded, of course, illegally, a boat in the docks of Boston in the 1700s, 1770s, of course. And it went on to be really one of these watershed landmark events in our resistance. And I felt like what the Grannies were doing a couple of years ago against the pipeline was really a Boston Tea Party moment. I'll read from the book now. Kashia and her friends walked through a wooded area and crop field, and then they hopped over a chain-link fence at a pipeline construction area. Crews were drilling with boring equipment, aiming for the river. Security guards stood all around. Kashia and her friends recognized it was private land of a farmer who had lost her rights to eminent domain. "There is something people have got to say and have got to understand," said fellow Granny Ann Christensen, an 80-year-old from Iowa City. "The motto of the 100 Grannies is to educate, advocate, and agitate. We'd rather educate, but if we have to, we're going to agitate and go to jail. It is serious, and time is very short. People don't seem to understand that this is urgent." And I thought that was a very profound moment, not only for Iowa, but for our nation at large.
Jeff Bigger's reading from his latest work, Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. He's currently based in Iowa City, an award-winning historian, journalist, and playwright. If you'd like to join our conversation with your take on resistance, perhaps you have given resistance at whatever time in your life, been part of a demonstration. Jeff just described there an account of a demonstration by Iowans that took place not too long ago. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Also joining us today, Tim Walsh, familiar voice on our talk shows, a presidential historian, former director, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Welcome back to the program, Tim.
Thanks, Ben. Glad to be with you.
Tell us, you've been sitting here next to Jeff, listening to some of the points he's bringing about with his new book. What is your take on resistance in American history?
This has been a terrific discussion, and in part it reminds me that we are a nation of resistors. You know, if you think that as a nation, we're all those malcontents from Europe and around the world who said, I don't want to put up with this. I'm going to get into a leaky boat and come to this country, and I feel willing to stand up and express myself. And then they, in effect, created a nation by a fundamental document of resistance, the Declaration of Independence, that people flock to every 4th of July to read, and you can barely read it. We so revered this document of resistance that we put it up in the sunlight for 50 years, and it just about faded away. But most people have committed the concepts to heart, our complaints against the King of England. And going on, there is a strong and deep tradition of resistance. In fact, I think Jeff makes a very good point. We are passing on a resistance to a new generation, and they're going to frame their own issues and their resistance as they choose to do this in this, you know, electronic social media age. Every generation, though, has had that responsibility, whether it's the 100 Grannies and their view of the environment, or those going back to women's suffrage. I dare say many of those grannies could have been born in an era when they didn't have the right to vote, and it was their mothers and grandmothers who resisted and got out there and protested. So we should all embrace the notion of resistance. It can, however, be also seen as a multitude of different issues and perspectives, because on any one issue, you might have two groups of resistors, mm-hmm. Depending upon what it is, whether it's women's suffrage or, for example, if from a conservative perspective, the right to life movement is a form of resistance to some extent. So you can be a conservative and be a resistor. The most important thing as an individual is that you say, I want to stand up and express myself. And that's what the First Amendment gives you the right to do as an American.
It's interesting, Jeff Biggers, you talk about in your book five areas that further define resistance. I think it tied into what Tim was talking about there, that this idea of a continuum, that it's not necessarily realized in the moment that it's doing for what it is, when it's happening for what it is, certainly not recognized by the people in power who are facing the resistance, right? Talk a little bit about that.
Right. You know, if we look once again at the Boston Tea Party, which I think is one of the most common examples we learn about in school, and we often dress up and think that's a very funny occasion, we kind of forget that was considered a very unpopular and radical event, that it wasn't actually until the 1830s that we began to address it as a nation as perhaps that was a patriotic event. And so, once again, it's in the eyes of the beholder that if you're in power, obviously you're going to denigrate and put down any acts of resistance to a duplicitous authority like we have today with the Trump administration. So I actually went back in history. And to me, what was very important was, once again, not to see resistance as only protest and only civil disobedience and only an electoral issue of let's get somebody in or out of office. But I saw resistance also as a larger concept of reclaiming the public commons and giving everyone a voice to speak. You know, to really, you know, one of the greatest challenges we've had for the past 250 years is really constantly defining and refining who is we the people.
Right.
And I think that's really what the resistance has done is, you know, constantly push the envelope forward to say, hey, there's more voices we need to include.
Public commons, you must feel that our public commons is a bit in danger when a lot of us aren't talking to others. We are so divided that we shy away from conversations that are needed in the public commons.
Exactly. You know, I think there's two levels of dialogue on that. Obviously, I think we need to have a very rigorous debate over ideas, and that's the beauty of the United States, both to hear other views, but also to have our views challenged, and that's very important. At the same time, I think it's fundamental that when we see a certain aspect of our democracy under attack, freedom of speech, freedom of the press right now, with the president referring to our colleagues in journalism as enemy of the people, we have to hold our ground and be able to argue from an aspect of history and ultimately constitutional rights, that this is not something that is negotiable, something we can say, you have an opinion, I have an opinion, but this is something that's a fundamental constitutional right that we have to defend.
But can't a resistor be someone, a resistor is seen as the, in the eye of the beholder of this resistor, right? You've mentioned Donald Trump many times, but some listening will see Donald Trump himself as a resistor. Many of his supporters see him as someone resisting and disrupting what they see as a corrupt establishment of government.
Yeah, and I think obviously I wouldn't agree with that. I see Donald Trump very much following in a very typical American tradition, especially from the late 19th century, of a period we called the Gilded Age, when corporate powers and robber barons played an incredible role in determining not only the future of our economy, but also our politics and policies. And I feel like we're regressing back to 100 years ago, prior to the progressive era, when so many of the pillars of our current system were built in terms of education and welfare and health and the right to enfranchise people. So I don't see Trump so much as a resistance against any kind of system as very much upholding a very corrupt part of our history himself.
Let's go to our phones quickly before we take a break. Dave in Des Moines, not much time. Dave, we're glad you're on. What's on your mind as we talk about resistance with Jeff Biggers and Tim Walsh?
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, Jeff, in your book, do you cover the 1988 Veterans Peace Convoy to Nicaragua by any chance?
I don't, but I think that would be a very meaningful chapter to include. You know, ultimately, my book had to be very brief and look at just a few landmark issues. It's not a sweeping social a sweeping
right
history.
On.
So, but I very much appreciate you calling.
I was on it, and I think we did a lot to help get that war stopped and before it started. And I would just like to say to everybody out there, sons and daughters of liberty, that we have a fragile democracy, and it doesn't work unless we stand up and take a place in it. And I invite everyone in Iowa to do that before we lose this beautiful constitution of ours. Thanks.
Dave in Des Moines, thank you. Let's go quickly over to Iowa City. Diane is with us in Iowa City. Hi, Diane. Coming up on a break, but we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, I wanted Jeff to perhaps speak to, you know, Reverend Theodore Parker from the who passed in 1850, is often, a quote of his is often attributed to Martin Luther King about the arc of freedom bends towards justice. And I wonder if he sees some of the actions by the institutional authorities right now who've appropriated the language of resistance, but the acts have actually been acts of institutionalizing power and dismantling and separating people from really being able to have that action. And people know the quote. It's the arc of freedom is long, but it bends towards justice.
Mm-hmm. And a favorite quote of President Obama, Tim Walz.
No, absolutely. And what Diane brings up, and I think is very important, and that is we seek leaders who will speak to power and who we can embrace. And just as Jeff cited William Sloan Coffin, and many, many people will cite Martin Luther King and others, and will make reference to the writings of Henry David Thoreau or Tom Paine, we seek to see in individuals the values we wish to have, the courage we wish to see in our citizens who will stand up for what is right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The NFL protest, bringing it back to the U.S., so this is something that has been going on for 2 years. Colin Kaepernick kneeling at the national anthem, that's a huge thing. You bring it up in your book. Why? We've got to go away in just a few seconds, but give us a preview.
What better way of reclaiming the commons than once again calling out an issue that's been overlooked, which is the reason why we had the NFL protest was to say, hey, there's this reality of police brutality and discrimination against African Americans that we need to recognize on a national level. And I think in many respects, we look at the first person to be gunned down in American Revolution is Crispus Attucks, an African American, in 1770 in the Boston Commons. And we see that up to today of what's happening with the NFL and Colin. It's a great continuum that he was upholding.
We'll be back with Jeff Biggers talking about his latest book, Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. Tim Walz is with us, presidential historian. When we come back, I think I'd like to ask Jeff about George Washington being on the wrong side of resistance. When we are back, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. So good you could join us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour with Jeff Biggers. He's an award-winning historian, journalist, playwright based in Iowa City. He has a new book out focusing on resistance. It's called Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. He's the author of several books. You've probably heard him on these airwaves before, Trials of a Scold, not too long ago. He's the winner of the Delta Prize for Literature and the David Brower Award for Environmental Reporting, also the founder of the Climate Narrative Project. Today, focusing on resistance throughout American history to get a sense of resistance. And we'd like to have you join our conversation, especially if you can tell us about your resistance. Perhaps you've staged resistance in your life and would like to tell us about it. In just a minute, we want to talk about how resistance can be transformative personally. But before that, let's join Patrick in Jefferson County. Patrick is with us. And before we get to Patrick, Jeff, Patrick is responding to the passage you read about the 100 grannies in Iowa City. Again, for listeners who may have just joined us, what were the 100 grannies protest?
They were protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline, which actually ran about 500,000 barrels of crude oil from the Canadian border all the way through the Dakotas and Iowa to the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm. Patrick in Jefferson County, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You were part of this protest.
Yes. A number of us from here, 350 Southeast Iowa, and just other interested people, met 100 Grannies folks, fellow activists, all the way back when they were holding public hearings at the very start of when Dakota Access was having donuts and coffee meetings in every county where the pipeline was going to pass through. And they turned it, you know, it's a funny thing. You know, you'd talk to them and they seem like nice, mild-mannered, middle-aged or older women. But boy, when push came to shove and somebody had to stand up at what we called the Mississippi Stand, the point you're mentioning is right at the point where they were drilling underneath the river coming up the other side in Illinois, which was the final leg of this thing to connect with pipelines that carry the crude down to the Gulf of Mexico. And it's an interesting example because, you know, this was a private corporation running a pipeline through Iowa, which was of no economic benefit whatsoever to the state or its residents, aside mm-hmm. from folks that are getting modest payments for, you know, the easements they granted. A lot of people didn't want to grant easements, and that is still in court. It has been appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court. We'll see what the Iowa Supreme Court has to say about the IUB exceeding its authority to issue permits for this in the first place, much less grant this private corporation the right of eminent domain.
Patrick, I want to have you zoom into your personal experience. We don't have all the time. We'd like to hear about this. No, you're fine. But I wanted to get to the point of first of all, had you participated in other protests before this one?
Oh yeah, all over the place. And the thing is, in this particular case, I went down there on five successive weekends to just, you know, support active protesters any way I could, and I finally had just had enough. In late September, I sent a letter, a phone call, an email, and then a registered letter down to Kelsey Warren, who is the CEO of Dakota Access Pipeline, headquarters in Dallas, received a confirmation back from the post office that someone in his office signed for it and it was delivered. And my purpose in early October was to go down there, hand a copy of this correspondence to the site foreman and say, look, this guy is not responding to me. I've invited him to just come up to Sandusky or Rosemont for lunch. And the three of us can sit down and I will explain what you can do with $3.9 billion instead of putting in a pipeline. How about solar and solar efficiency and a few things like that?
Right. Patrick, we've got other callers. Did you feel you made a difference in a few words?
Well, with me and 100 grannies and a lot of other people, I think we let them know that they aren't going to get away with this. And I'm sorry to say, oil's been flowing through that pipeline for about a year now. But I really hope before it's done that we shut them down. That was the whole point.
Okay, Patrick in Jefferson County, you can hear the energy in his voice. Tim Walsh, talk a little bit about, and there will be people in our audience who have protested. What an experience that can be for an individual.
What you hear in Patrick's voice is the transformative nature of what protest will do in the sense of giving meaning and frame to your life and your values as a citizen. And you hear in his voice passion. You hear a lot of detail, of course, and determination. Even though he may not have been as successful as he had hoped initially, you see going forward a determination not to give up. And I'm thinking of other Iowans, and it popped into my head, Tinker versus Des Moines, for example, the nature of standing up as a young person in school and how that fundamentally changed her life and her family's life and, quite frankly, the lives of every high school student in the country and their ability to be able to speak up. So that's what protest will do. And in some ways, it's intoxicating, but it's at a higher order and a higher level.
You have protested yourself, Jeff Biggers. You have researched protests throughout our American history. Is intoxicating a word you would also use?
I would say definitely transformative is a great word, you know, in terms of it definitely has invigorated and galvanized, I was going to mix those words together, many people's lives and really made them even better Americans and more dedicated Americans in terms of their role and their place and their contribution to our society. I think what very important, though, is that resistance actually gives us a allows us to share Tom Paine's idea of a more equal democracy. And it makes kind of the role of resistance not only to provide a place of we the people, but almost as a truth and reconciliation commission of people who've been left out of kind of the official rendition of history. I'd like to give you an example, in fact, with
sure.
George Washington and someone who worked in his household. There was a woman named Ona Judge. And in fact, when George Washington, our first president, was inaugurated there in New York City, that's where our first capital was, of course, not far off Wall Street, which is very emblematic of our future. There was a woman watching and hearing all this great talk about freedom and breaking from our enslavement from Britain. And of course, she was an African-American slave. She was called a dowry slave. She was going to be passed down from generation to generation in Martha Washington's family. Ona Judge realized she needed to have her own resistance. And it wasn't until the presidential mansion had moved to Philadelphia that she actually one day served one supper to George Washington and his family. She left the back door. She jumped on a schooner and she went up to New Hampshire. And our president, of course, who, of course, played a vital role as the military leader of our American Revolution, actually went after this enslaved American. He put an ad in the newspaper. And it wasn't until years later that Ona Judge was interviewed. And she said, how did it feel to be a fugitive from the very first president of the United States? And she said, I wasn't a fugitive. I was a liberated American. And I felt like her story was once again emblematic of really what the American resistance was about, not simply going against our system, but redefining it, actually giving a more equal democracy to the original aspirations and challenges and promises of what our American Revolution was all about.
Jeff Biggers, his latest book, Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition, joined also by Tim Walsh, presidential historian in our studio today. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. After that story of George Washington, which we don't find in our elementary school textbooks or really very many textbooks at all, I feel I'm called to take this call from Washington County, a woman named Martha. Oh, my goodness. Martha, the stars have aligned. Your question is next, or have you been a part of a resistance?
Yes. I want to make sure this program includes the quiet, constant, totally dedicated resistance by those of us who choose not to use and abuse animals for food.
Mm.
I first heard the word probably on public radio when I was a kid, vegetarian, and I said, Mommy, what's a vegetarian? And she said, it's a person who doesn't eat meat. So that's when the seed was planted. Then in college in the early 70s, I was became very aware of Diet for a Small Planet by Francis Moore LePay, spelling out how it's just such a
right.
awkward way to feed people. And anyway, that resistance goes on constantly. I think about it every day. It's no deprivation.
So it sounds like a transformative. This quiet sort of resistance has transformed your life. Martha, in Washington County, thank you very much for your call. Tim Walsh.
I just wanted to put my archivist hat on, too, and it occurred to me that Dave and Patrick and Martha and so many others, Mary Beth Tinker and so forth, we need to make sure we save the documentation of resistance because people live in the moment, and you want to make sure that we have diaries and letters and posters and all these things so that future Jeff Biggers can write the next generation or next edition of these books, because too often when moments take place or movements take place on a local level, the documentation doesn't get saved. And so with Dakota Access, I know there have been archivists in the field. Just like a good anthropologist, an archivist is collecting documentation.
Jeff Biggers, why is that point important?
I think it's very important because also I think it realizes that our resistance today is on the shoulders of other people, often, as our last caller pointed out, who are quiet and unsung heroes who we don't recognize. I really wanted to look at Henry David Thoreau, which, of course, we often read as one of the original writers about civil disobedience. But I actually had to go before Thoreau and realize there was a Native American, a Pequot author by the name of William Apis, who, in fact, was thrown into jail in 1833 when he worked with the Mashpee, which was a tribe on Cape Cod, to get their independence. When he was thrown into jail, William Apis wrote a beautiful statement saying, hey, there's nothing you can do. My conscience is right. I have a right to do this, and you can imprison me for as long as you want. There was a young student at Harvard College at that moment named Henry David Thoreau who read about this in the newspaper, this really incredible fundamental idea of disobedience as a civil duty. And of course, Thoreau, 15 years later, went on to really change our nation with his refusal to pay taxes for the Mexican-American War. But part of my role as a historian was to recover this, which reverse what I call historicide, people who've actually been forgotten or removed from history, and to put them back into history to realize, in fact, there are these stepping stones. There are many people that we really need to recognize who have been forgotten in history, especially in terms of this wonderful continuum of resistance in our country.
Finishing up our hour conversation about resistance with Jeff Biggers and Tim Walch and you. A lot of interest in this topic. So let's go back to the phones. Leonard is joining us from Des Moines. Hi, Leonard. What's your take on resistance?
Are you having fun yet?
Boy, are we ever. What's your take on resistance?
Well, my last name is Tinker.
Oh, great.
You are related to the Tinkers. This is a public school protest in Des Moines.
Mary Beth was and is my sister. John was and is my brother. Chris Eckhart, who was at Roosevelt, alas, died of cancer 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay. For those who don't know, this was a silent protest in the schools, black armbands worn in the schools, protesting the Vietnam War, and decided by the courts that this was within the freedom of speech.
First of all, whoever gave the case gave it incorrectly. It's actually Tinker et al. Versus Des Moines Independent Community School District, not versus Des Moines.
All right, Tim. Leonard?
The funny part of it is, if the school board had ignored the armbands, a week later, nobody would have remembered what happened.
Right. That's true. That's interesting.
But in due course, the Supreme Court ruled that the Supreme Court was good enough to advise the Des Moines School Board as to what the First Amendment really stands for.
Right. Leonard, the last name Tinker, forever bound with protest and resistance in a very good way in our country. You must be proud of that.
Well, for what it's worth, the case was actually filed by my father, because minors are not allowed to bring suit in federal court. So a person of adulthood brings suit as, quote, next friend, end quote, to minor children.
Right.
As it happens, I'm the third. The case was actually filed by Leonard Tinker Jr., my father. So, and kids doing term papers know it came out of Des Moines.
Right.
They call Des Moines Information, ask for Leonard Tinker, and get me. Then they say, did you have kids who wore armbands back in the 60s? And I'll say no. And they'll apologize for bothering me, and I'll tell them, but I did have a brother and sister.
Now, to the point, I don't know if you were on with us a little bit earlier, Leonard, to the point that when things happen, protests happen in history, they're often seen years later in a different perspective. Now, take us back to, this is the late 60s?
Right. Well, it was the mid-60s. 65. Okay. Christmas of 65 was when they did it.
Okay, 65, even better, because the Vietnam is not as highly protested in 65 as it is later.
Right.
Was it recognized? Was it controversial
wore these? Hate phone calls.
Hate phone calls.
Yes. Now, on the other hand, in fairness, the decision came down February of 1969. By the time the decision came down, the war in Vietnam was decidedly unpopular, and people were asking, what's the big deal? Why do we care?
Leonard, Leonard, thank you.
Sir.
You as a historical figure, thank you for calling our show.
Here's another one. Your guest will appreciate this. A couple of years ago, I took my 9-year-old grandson, and we went over to West Branch.
Right?
Wonderful.
Prior to that time, Sullivan had never heard of Hoover. But now Sullivan knows who Herbert Hoover was.
Well, I hope
I
hope you had a good long visit to the Presidential Library there.
We did, and we enjoyed it immensely.
Wonderful.
Leonard in Des Moines, thank you very much for joining us. We've got about 5 minutes left. Jeff Biggers, a part of your book toward the end deals with climate change. And I like one of the sentences you have here, and I think this pertains to this as to many of the resistance instances in your book. History does not provide a blueprint for our own times, but it does belie our arrogance in thinking that we are the first generation to face certain challenges.
Right, exactly. You know, and once again, our last caller, I think, really makes that very clear. I thought it was beautiful when the Parkland students in Florida invoked Tinker as their right to protest and walk out. In fact, when my son walked out of the high school this spring from City High in Iowa City, he was invoking the Tinker decision. And so once again, we're realizing that we're following in this tradition, that, you know, we're not the first people to pick this up. And this includes climate change. Thomas Paine said a very amazing thing in his Common Sense about our American Revolution. He said, resistance is an act of renewal, that we have it in our power to invent the world again. And so when we actually were negotiating with Great Britain in 1782 in Paris to really decide how we were going to move forth as a nation, Thomas Paine wrote this remarkable letter to a French writer saying, hey, you know, two things are fundamental. The revolution has transformed us as people. We're going to try to set aside our prejudice. But more importantly, we're going to follow the rule of science and join the nations of the rest of the world, that there would be no America first, that in fact we would work with the world to solve our issues and solve our problems in whatever moment. And I think that, to me, ultimately is about the greatest challenge we're facing today, which is climate change and how we can be part of a resistance movement to go against so much that's happening in the White House today that is working against us and really resulting in so much environmental devastation that ultimately may not be reversible. So I see really an act of resistance, but an act of renewal following this wonderful American tradition.
Before we leave this conversation, Tim Walsh, what's on your mind that you want to get out?
Well, it just reminds me that when we think about resistance, remember that it takes a great measure of courage for ordinary people to do such extraordinary things. Often it is caught up in the midst of controversy, as Leonard Tinker suggested. In 65, it took real courage to in effect, act. But the courts moved slowly, and by 69, it seemed less courageous. It often is transformative. We've seen that, and it's idealistic. And these are elements that are qualities that we all hope to embrace. Mm-hmm. So that participating in resistance to some extent is a fundamentally advantageous and desirable activity. And as Jeff suggests, it's about as American as apple pie.
Right. We talked about the Tea Party, Thomas Paine, and so forth. We had a Tea Party movement here more recently in 2008 and 2009, calling for lower national debt, lower deficit, reduced spending, lower taxes, smaller government at the onset of the Obama administration. Does that fit resistance? Tea Party activists around today in the Republican Party, they are resistors, right?
You know, if you're going to take a broad definition, once again, I go back to this fundamental creedal of Tom Paine and our forerunners of saying, is there this duplicitous authority that's attacking our democracy? And how do we fend off these attacks of these fundamental promises and challenges and aspirations of our American Revolution? Once again, that Constitution that we hold dear. So I think rather than talking about the Tea Party, I would rather look at something that happened during the Boston Tea Party times, which is how do we defend our freedom of speech and our freedom of the press. Right now we're dealing with a situation where the White House refers to us in our journalism world as enemy of the people. And I think that concerns me, but also forces me once again to go back to history to look at times like in 1798 when we passed the Sedition Act, which made it illegal to write or print or say anything against the government, and how once again in this dark time it was journalists themselves who led the resistance to uphold the fundamental credo of our Constitution that we have a right to dissent, we have a right to defend this democracy. So that's the kind of American tradition I think we need to be upholding.
Tim Walsh?
Yes, just to reiterate that, if you were a strict constructionist, let's go back to the First Amendment, because that underscores the bedrock justification and tradition of what resistance is all about. Freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of press are codified in our Constitution. And that is the seedling for all resistance that follows.
Jeff Biggers, in the final few seconds, give us a little reaction. From your book tour, you've been on the East Coast, you've been on the West Coast as well?
Right. And I kicked it off in Arizona. You probably would think the last place for resistance, but there people remind us that as Trump was elected, Maricopa County actually kicked out Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is considered one of the earliest supporters of Trump himself. And at my reading, there was this massive turnout of young Latinos using my reading for voter registration. And ultimately, that was the answer to my son's book. You know, my son asked me at the beginning of the book, is there hope? And as I looked at this new generation of young Latinos who are working so hard on so many different levels of justice, but also to be involved in our system and electoral change and to really move us forward. I said, hey, I feel great. The resistance is in the hands of a new generation now.
Jeff Biggar's latest book, Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. Thank you for being with us, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Walsh, presidential historian, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Thank you for being with us again, Tim.
You bet, Ben.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Also help today from Lucy McGeehee. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.